that, dear listeners, was the Radio Sai Vintage Bhajan Classroom. It's now to move on, time to move on to the rest of the programs. Generally, after the Bhajan Classroom, we have the program Shravanam Mananam Nirvidhyasanam, and I, Prem from Team Radio Sai, host it along with Brother Hari from the Central Trust. Now, this week, we're going to take a break. We're going to start a new discourse, but that discourse needs a little bit of processing still, and we are not ready with that discourse. We will be continuing with that discourse next week. It's a new discourse. There are two more discourses to go in the 1991 summer course series, so I'm hoping that all of you will join us again for the continuation of that series. For now, I'm going to play for you a talk which I had the opportunity to deliver 2 years ago in the Satsang Hall in Prashanthi Nilayam. Much of what I speak in this particular talk has come from what Swami has said in the summer course discourses 1990 and 1991. It's nothing new. There is nothing that I am sharing from my learning or knowledge. It is most of what Swami has said. I hope you'll find this talk interesting. The title of the talk was Bridging the True Self with the Superficial Self. I would love to know what you think of the talk. You can always write to our feedback mail, listener@radiosai.org, and let us know what you think of it. As promised, I'll join you again next week at 7:30 with Brother Hari for the next episode of Shravanam Mananam Nirvidhyasanam. After this talk, you will be joined by Brother Sai Prakash for the Outside Inside Deep Inside program, where he will continue talking about the symphony, the Sai Symphony, which was first staged for the 90th birthday here in Prashanthi Nilayam. Thereafter, it was staged once in New Delhi, and the recent most one was in Germany. So he'll be here to talk about that. But for now, it's over to this talk, Bridging the Superficial Self with the Real Self. Happy listening. Offering my most humble pranams at Bhagavan's lotus feet. I pray to Swami, He gives us all the understanding that He alone is the one who speaks, He alone is the one who listens. Elders, brothers and sisters, I am to all of you. Some of you would have read the topic for the day. Definitely I'm not too sure how capable or how up to the task I am to speak on this topic. But nevertheless, you could applaud me for the brave attempt. But as the topic went, we're talking about bridging two things. One is the superficial self and the real self. How do we bridge the superficial self with the real self? Now, if I were to ask you, what is our real self? What are we really? I think the answer is quite simple, right? Because we've heard so many times Swami say it in the discourses. We know that we are divine. We know that we are the absolute consciousness. You can call it anything. But we know that in the core, we are that divinity which is perfect, which is beyond illusion, which is beyond pain, suffering. But I would just make a suggestion, coming into this talk with that belief would be like going into an exam hall with answers written in a secret paper. Because that's not going to do any help to us. Because when we go in for an exam, the exam is meant to test the process of learning, not whether you know the answer or not. Because the answer could be got. But education itself is a process. You are not taught subjects. Personally speaking, I've learned chemistry, but I use hardly any of the chemistry that I've learned at school or at college. But what education guarantees you is that when you finish that course of education, you are told, now you have learned the art of learning. You've not learnt a subject. You've not learnt mathematics. You've not learnt economics. But you've learnt the art of learning. So now you can go forth and learn anything that you want. And that is why the process is important.
not exactly the answer. Because when I say what is our real self, we all know the answer. Because we have heard it so many times from so many people from different platforms. But what is beautiful and what is necessary and what is important is in the process of arriving at it. And in the course of this talk, that's what I'll try to do, because if we look at our own lives, we might not be able to conclude that I am divine. That's the farthest to reach. But we can definitely come to some conclusions which are a little removed from our everyday experience. Only we have to look at ourselves and ask some valid questions, relevant questions, and give some honest answers. There is this 1980 classic novel written by a very good writer called Robert Ludlum. It's a very famous novel. It's called Born Identity. It was televised later. It was made into one of the most popular English movies. A brilliant novel. It's called Born Identity. It's about a man called Jason Bourne. It's a very interesting story. The novel's plot starts with a small gun battle in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea on a ship, where one man is shot at and he is thrown off board. And after he's thrown off board, the ship goes up in flames. So this man is finally washed to the shores. And there the fishermen community pick him up and they take him to a local doctor who examines him and finds that there are a lot of bullet marks on him, and one bullet has apparently hit his head. So he nurses him back to good health. But when this man is back to his consciousness, he's completely lost all memory of his past. He knows nothing of where he came from, what is his name, who is he. He has absolutely no clue. So the entire story after this is how he discovers his identity. So that's why it's called Born Identity. But the interesting thing is, when this doctor examines him, he finds that there seems to have been a plastic surgery done on his face. So that complicates it even further, because the face that he has is not his real face. So there is a change of identity in between. So even if he discovers whose face he is wearing, he doesn't know who he really is. All that he is left with is flashes of memory. Suddenly he sees something, he hears a name, he looks at some scene and it starts reminding him of something of the past, but there is absolutely no connectivity. So he starts chasing these clues in search of his identity. Swami says that when a child is born, the first thing that it does is it starts crying. And what does the child say? It says, "Koham, koham, koham. Who am I? Who am I?" And Swami would tell that, you know, till the point where the soul enters the human womb, it is actually conscious of its past, of its journey. But after that entrance into the womb happens, it's totally blank. And now when it is born, it's absolutely no idea where it is. It starts asking, "Koham, koham, who am I, who am I?" You can imagine the darkness the child is thrown into. We all have gone through it. We don't remember it. But it has no clue. And if you observe a child, it even looks at its own body very curiously. It looks at its hand. It looks at its feet. It still doesn't know that that body is me. It still is wondering, who am I, who am I, where am I, where have I come from, what am I here for? And after that stage, what happens? People start giving answers to it. The mother comes and says, "You are my son, you are my daughter." The father comes and says, "You are my son, you are my daughter." The siblings come and say, "You are our brother, you are our sister." And then in a slow process of learning, the child learns that, okay, I am so and so. You're given a name. And every time your name is called, you are asked to rest. So it is slowly drilled into the head that you are the name, you are the body. But interestingly, I ask, "Who am I?" My father comes and says, "You are my son." I ask my father, "Who are you?" He says, "I am so and so's son." Then who is he? He is so-and-so's son. Aren't all the answers we are collecting in the process nothing but arbitrary references? There is this husband who is getting ready for work early in the morning. You can understand the tension and that hurry they are all in. He yells at his wife, "Where is my mobile phone?" "It's just next to the wallet." "Where is my wallet?" "It's just next to the mobile phone." "No, where is the mobile phone and wallet?" "Next to each other." Are answers like this of any use to us? But it is these very answers we live our life with. Who am I? I'm so-and-so's father. I'm so-and-so's son. I'm so-and-so's brother. Story goes that, you know, a man goes to a master in search of spiritual enlightenment. He tells the master, "Master, please guide me." The master says, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm Krishna." "That's your name. Who are you?" "I'm a businessman." "That's your profession. Who are you?" "I'm a human being." "That's your birth. Who are you?" It is this very answer we all are looking for, answers to quench this thirst. But all the while what we get is only arbitrary references. Now when Swami used to perform this gram seva, we would be sent out in all directions into all villages. So we needed a form of communication. We had to keep contacting the base in Prashantinilam and saying that we are short of food, we are short of saris, we need more stock, or we are lost, tell us how to get back. So we had set up this communication system that each truck will have a mobile device. Those days there were no mobile phones, were not so popular. So we used to have these wired mobile devices. And we would have a home base which we would contact and say that, you know, this is where we are, this is how much task we have finished. And anybody who could speak coherently two sentences would become a mobile operator. That's how we all would become mobile operators. But we had very little sense of how to handle it, most of us. So that gave opportunity to a lot of mirth. A lot of funny incidents used to happen in the process of communication. So once one particular truck was lost, or in the sense they entered a village, they were not sure whether that was the village they were supposed to service. So he calls up the home base. He says, "Mobile 16 to home base, please come in." The home base says, "Yes. How can I help you?" He says, "I'm in a village, I don't know which village it is. I want to know where are we supposed to go." So the person in the home base says, "Please come in with your location." This boy says, "I am placed right behind the truck which is in front of me." He says, "Where are you?" "My truck is behind the truck which is in front of me." And this exactly is what we are doing with our own identity. If at any point we can fix anyone's identity, maybe from there we can work backwards, isn't it? You know, when in school we used to have this puzzle. In the quiz contest, many times this would be asked. Fill in the blanks. Dasharatha is Rama's father's dash. We all know that Dasharatha is Rama's father, but how do you say Dasharatha is Rama's father's dash? And the answer is quite simple. Dasharatha is Rama's father's name. Dasharatha is not Rama's father, Dasharatha is Rama's father's name. It was a trick question, but isn't this the reality? That we are all the time carrying references which are not real at all. So who are we? But before answering the question, why is it necessary to know who we are? I mean, aren't we all comfortable going on with life? Why do I have to know who I am? I mean, I have a body, I've grown up with this body, I've grown up to believe that I am this body. Why is it necessary to know who I am? Swami says that all spiritual inquiry starts with one feeling. Do you think it's the feeling of vairagya? No, it's not. Do you think it's the feeling of devotion, of selfless love? No, it is not. Swami says it's the feeling of subhecha. It's the feeling of welfare of oneself. all spiritual journey starts with a desire to lead a happy, good life. And isn't that a part of each one of our dreams? We all want to live a happy life, right? We don't want to lead a life which is pressed down by pains and sufferings. We all want to lead a life which is comfortable. And Swami says, to lead such a life, you need to take on a spiritual journey. So Subhechha is actually the starting point of the spiritual journey. So that is why we have to know who we are. There is this beautiful story, they say, that there is a caravan of camels traveling in the desert. So every night they have to pitch somewhere and they all stay there and again continue their journey in the morning. So it's a caravan of about 12 camels. So end of the day they pitch tent. So the man who's taking care of the camels comes to the chief and says, Master, we're having a problem here. What is the problem? He says, we seem to have dropped the peg somewhere. You know, the peg with which they use to hold the camel back, they kind of dig it into the sand and tie the camel to that peg. He says, we have 12 camels, we have only 11 pegs. What do we do? You can't leave the camel untied, it'll run away. You can't tie two camels to one peg, then they'll uproot it. So what do we do? The chief says, it's very simple. Peg the 11 camels and pretend as though you're pegging the 12th camel. Pretend as though you're tying it to a peg. It will stay there whole night. And it is said that most of us are bound like that. We've been told that you're bound. And we've believed it. Maybe we are not. If we are not, what a waste of a life it is to think that we are bound and then at the end of it realize, oh, I was actually not bound at all. Had I known this, I would have lived much better. You know, I think today is the day of the movies. There's another movie which is called The Gaslight. It's an iconic movie. It's actually a stage play which got adapted into a movie. It's called Gaslight. In fact, it became so popular that it became a study in psychology itself. You know, in the story what happens is, they have this husband who is trying to, you know, get rid of his wife. So he comes up with this unique idea of trying to drive her crazy. So what does he do? There is a gas light in those days, 1940s, instead of a bulb, you used to have a gas light. That's the gas light in the room. He would manipulate it in such a way that it would flicker all night. And the wife would look at the gas light and say, that light is flickering, can't we fix it? And the husband will say, no, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Then she'll say, no, but it's flickering, I can see it. He says, no, but it's fine. And he would do this repeatedly day after day, day after day. And that lady loses the confidence she has in her own perception. She knows that the light is flickering, she can see it. But the husband says, no, it is not flickering. He even gets his friends to say that, no, it's not flickering, it's your imagination. So gaslighting has become a term in psychology. It is a type of mental abuse. Where something is not there, but you're repeatedly told it is there, it is there, it is there, and it actually drives you crazy. And you start believing what you would not believe otherwise. That sounds a little too sinister. Let's go to a little lighter example which Swami gives. A very beautiful example. Swami would say that there's a group of friends who go out into the clearing in the forest. This is playing a small game of hide and seek. All go around hiding somewhere. So there is this one boy who goes behind a bush and he finds this huge stone which looks like a Ganapati idol. Looks like a Ganesha idol. It's a big rock and a bigger rock which kind of looks like the tummy of Ganapati. In just where you would draw a navel for Ganesha, there is a hole. A little boy, curious fellow, what does he do? He puts his finger into that hole. And sadly for him, there's a scorpion in that hole. It stings him. He pulls out his hand and he looks back. All his friends are around him. So you can't make a fool of yourself in front of your friends. So he bites his lip, doesn't squeal. Then the friends notice that something's gone wrong. What did you do? What did you do? And what does this boy say? You see this hole there? You put your finger inside, cool breeze is coming from that side. So the next adventurous boy comes, puts his finger inside, gets a sting. And he also thinks the same way. I can't shout. So embarrassing in front of my friends. And he looks around and says, yes, it's very cool in there. And one after the other, each of those boys put their finger inside. And till the end, everybody says, yes, it's very cool in there. Everybody feels the pain, but all deny it. Everybody sees, I've experienced it. It's their real experience, but they all deny it. Why? That's how it is. Just as a side note, please don't take it seriously. Sometimes when Swami speaks to his students, Swami would tell the story and say, this is how married men behave. All will get stung by married life, but they'll say it's very good if you get married. That's typically Swami, but of course, if the institution of marriage was not a spiritual one, Swami would not have performed so many. But typically Swami's humor. But how real is that? How real is that? Aren't we all going through that? Haven't we all trained our mind to not perceive what is right in front of us, but perceive what we are told that this is how it should be perceived? We all look at our body, it has grown with us. But, that's the funny thing. Somebody comes and tells you, you're not the body. How can I not be the body? It's grown with me. Ever since I was born, it was always with me. And whatever I did, it responded. I exercise, it becomes slim. I eat too much, I become fat. So how can you come and tell me that I am not this body? Am I not this body? For instance, you come and pinch me, I feel the pain. You pinch the person sitting next to me, I don't feel the pain. So that's not me and this is me, isn't it? It's quite simple. That's not me, this is me. You pinch me, I feel the pain. You give pleasure to this body, I feel the happiness, feel the joy. How then can you come and tell me that I'm not this body? Very simple. I'm sitting here, you take a knife and slit my finger, I feel the pain. You anesthetize my hand and do the same act. Do I feel the pain? So how can I say that anything done to this body is actually done to me? There is a process by which I can detach myself from what the body undergoes. It's medically possible. It's not spiritual. It is possible. We've all gone through it. Any of us who've gone through surgery have seen it. So we can be in a state of peace even when this body is harmed. So are we still this body? And this does not need spirituality, really, that's the thing. But of course, spiritually too, it can be done. It is said that there was one, Swami Turyananda, I think one of the direct disciples of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. He had this big wound in his finger which had to be operated. They got the physicians to have a look and they looked at him and they said, it needs a minor surgery but it's going to be painful. So let me give you a drug and anesthetize that part of the hand. And Swami Turyananda says, no, I don't need it. You can go ahead with the surgery. He says, but Swamiji, it's going to be painful. And he says, no problem, you go ahead. Just give me 2 minutes, he says. So he goes into a meditative state and puts out his hand. And the entire surgical procedure is done without any anesthetic. The doctor is surprised, but he's fine after that. So the next day this man is taking rest in the hospital ward. The doctor comes to have a look. The hand is bandaged, so he has to remove the bandage and see whether it's healed. So Swamiji is sleeping, the doctor comes, starts opening the bandage and he squeals. He says, what are you doing? It hurts. The doctor is surprised. He said, yes, it is supposed to hurt, but the surgery I did yesterday was supposed to hurt more. You went through that without any drugs, but why are you shouting now? And he said, I was not prepared for this. Had you told me that you're going to do it, I could have prepared to distance myself from the pain. So isn't it really possible to achieve that? Whether we can or we cannot, secondary. But the very fact that it can be, isn't it a fact that we are not the body? fine, we might not consider ourselves the body. We might consider ourselves as somebody who's wearing the body, which is also fine. You know, yesterday I had a lot of hair, today I've cut my hair. It doesn't mean I've become lesser. Of course, a part of my body has been cut and thrown away, but still I am I. So what, if I'm not the body, I can at least consider that the body is part of the apparatus that is me. I might not be just the body, but the body is part of me. Then the next belief we go into is, am I not this personality then? Am I not this person who's grown from an infant to a child, from a child to a teenager, from a teenager to a young adult, to an adult, to an old man? Am I not this personality then? Because whatever I see, whatever I learn, I'm actually dumping into this personality. I'm beginning to embody it in my personality. So am I not this personality? Can you come and tell me that you're not this person? You're somebody else? You're God? Come on. You cannot tell that, right? I am this personality which I'm carrying around with its characteristics, with its the way of talking, with the way of thinking, with the way of acting. How can you say that I'm not this personality? We all have had this experience of having a dream, haven't we? We all have dreamt, we all have slept, we all have had a dream. When we wake up from a dream, why is it that we feel that the dream was unreal? What makes a dream more unreal than the waking state? It is. The dream is unreal. Let's admit that first. So what makes the dream so unreal while the waking state appears to be real? What is that which differentiates? Well, one thing is the temporary nature of the dream. It ends. And you have this waking state which is a continuum. You sleep, you can come back to the waking state, right? The dream ends. The dream lasts for a very short time. So we have it drilled in our heads that which does not last is not real. That which has a momentary existence is not reality. It's momentary. Right? That's why we comfortably say that the dream is unreal. I dream of myself being a king. I dream of myself being a celebrity. I wake up in the morning, it's gone. I'm not worried about that. I knew it's a dream. Or I suffer in the dream, I wake up, it's gone. So the temporary nature of anything actually tells us that it's unreal, isn't it? What is the other thing about the dream which makes us believe that it's unreal? There is no logic in a dream. There is absolutely no logic in a dream. You wake up, you try to recapitulate what you have had in a dream. A sequence of unrelated things. Somebody comes up somewhere, somebody tells you something, suddenly you're here, suddenly you're somewhere. I'm reminded of when I was in school, I had a dream where I'm walking back from school with my school bag and a water bottle in my hand. Slowly walking, thoughtfully, thinking of something, I'm walking. In the dream, I'm imagining that I'm walking for so long, and suddenly I look around, there's all sand all around me. I'm wondering, where am I? A man walks up in a camel, and I look at him and ask, what place is this? He says, it's the Sahara Desert. And I'm not surprised in the dream. In my dream, I'm thinking, oh God, I've walked so long. But when I wake up, I know that it was unreal because there was no logic in that dream. There was absolutely no logic in that dream. But in the dream, that lack of logic did not affect me. In the dream, it was fine. Yeah, fine. I mean, I would have walked a little longer than usual and crossed the ocean and reached the Sahara Desert. But it was fine. So, the lack of permanency and the lack of logic lets us define something as unreal, isn't it? But look at our own lives. How much of logic is there? The question which most people will ask if you have a spiritual forum is, why do good people suffer? Why do innocent people suffer? Is there anybody who can logically explain this without talking of some concept which is similar to karma theory? Is it possible to logically explain this disparity without talking about something which suggests that we are somebody who is traveling from body to body, from birth to birth. One of my friends was saying that his uncle and his nephew had a debate. And the nephew said, "I don't believe in karma theory." He said, "Good, suit yourself. But come up with another theory which can explain all this and try how much you can abstain from referring to the karma theory." I think it's the author of that book, the Catholic priest meets Sai Baba. He writes in that book, if my memory serves me right, it's in that book that I've read this. He says that there is this reference in the Bible where Jesus is walking along with his followers and his apostles. They come across a man who is a leper. Jesus cures him and they walk away. And the disciples ask Jesus, "Master, why is he suffering?" And Jesus says, "Because of his sins of the past." So they say, "Fine." They walk forward, they go to the next village. There they find a blind boy. And this boy is blind from birth. So Jesus cures him too. And now the disciples ask him, "Now you tell us, why is he suffering? Why is he blind?" And very casually Jesus says, "Because of his sins of the past," and walks away. So to define, to bring logic to this reality, without our knowledge, we have to bring in the concept that this personality is only momentary. That we are traveling and this is a personality we have adorned, and at some point we will discard it and adorn another personality. So isn't it true that even this personality is unreal? Isn't it true that just like how we go in and go out of the dream, we are going in and going out of this personality, this body, this character and everything? So we are not the body. And we are not this personality too. And when I say personality, it means the mind, the intellect, the intelligence, the smartness, the talent, everything. We go in and come out of it. And one of the classic examples of, you know, the dream getting to confuse, I think it's a very well-known story, the story of Janaka. But I think it's worth repeating it again. Janaka is lying on his royal bed and he has this dream where someone comes and tells him, "King, the enemy is attacking us." So Janaka gets up, he wears his armor, he picks up his sword, he goes for battle, but it's too late. The army of the enemies have surrounded him, they capture him, they beat him up, and they say, "We have taken over your kingdom." So the enemy king says, "Alright, you're a king, so I will not kill you, but I banish you. Leave the kingdom." So Janaka says, in the dream he sees that overnight from a king he has become a pauper. He is walking through the streets of his own city and nobody is there to feed him or give him water. He is thirsty, he is starved. Walking he goes to the next city. And it is said that in the next city he goes into a temple where somebody is doing Narayan Seva. It's a big line, he goes and stands there. And just as he reaches that counter, he finds the food is over. So the man who is serving says, "The food is over, I'm sorry, but maybe I can scrape what is there in the vessel and give you whatever is left." So Janaka thinks, "What blight has come on me? I'm a king and I'm begging for leftovers now." So he says, "Alright, I'm hungry, please give me at least that." So he gives him the leftovers. And just when Janaka is about to eat it, an eagle from above comes, swoops down, knocks down that vessel which he's having in his hand. And he sees that only food which he could lay his hands on in 2 days mixed with dust. And Janaka is thinking, "What is this? What has come on me?" And just then, the royal attendant comes and says, "King, what happened? What happened?" Because he sees that, you know, all the contortions in the sleeping king's face. He seems to be troubled. He wakes him up and says, "What happened? Are you having a nightmare?" Janaka wakes up. Two things. Janaka is a very, very intelligent person. Because he was a person who was always looking keenly at every experience he was having. He was asking deep questions in whatever he was going through in life. That was the characteristic which led him to the experience which he had. And the second thing was how real that dream was. That dream was so real and so logical that when he woke up from it, he couldn't deny it, because it was so real. So when he wakes up, Swami says, he starts lamenting, Adi nijama, idi nijama, Adi nijama, idi nijama. Was that true or is this true? Was that dream true or what I am awake back in my royal bed, back with my soldiers in the protection of my palace? Is this the reality or was that the reality? And he gets obsessed with this thought. The attendant goes and calls the queen. The queen comes and asks, King, what has happened? He says, Adi nijama, idi nijama. Is that true or is this true? They run, they call the preceptor, they call the ministers. He keeps asking the same question. Is that true or is this true? Is that true or is this true? And Swami says that they finally go to preceptor Vasishta. They go and invite Vasishta to come and clarify this problem that he is in. Nobody knows, because Janaka is not even narrating what he saw in his dream. He is not even mentioned that it was a dream. He is only going on telling, was that true, is this true, was that true, is this true. They don't even know what he is referring to. Vasishta comes with his knowledge of wisdom. He realizes what the king has gone through. So Vasishta asks Janaka, the king, when you were starving, when you were wounded, did you feel that it was real? He says, yes. None of those who were there in that scene could understand this conversation. He said, yes, it felt real. When you were wounded, when you were starving, did you feel the comfort that you're feeling now? When you're lying on your royal bed, the comfort and the security which you're feeling now, did you feel it then? He says, no, I didn't feel it then. And then he says, now, are you feeling the pain that you felt then? Are you feeling that starvation and the pain and the wound that you felt then? He says, no, I don't feel it now. So, neither is that real, nor is this real. Neither is that real, nor is this real. Because the experience was the same. The waking state is nothing but a long-lasting dream. The dreaming state was a short-lived dream. Neither is that real, nor is this real. So immediately Janaka asks, what is real then? Then Vasishta says, you felt the pain then, you are feeling the comfort now. You were scared then, you are feeling the security now. You are real. You are the one who is dreaming the dreaming state and dreaming the waking state. This is an experience we all go through, but maybe we just have to pause and look at it. Just like when I started, I said the story of Jason Bourne. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know what he is for. Where is he from? But he starts picking clues from his own life as he is going through. He finds a bank account. He chases it. He finds a picture in his wallet. He starts trying to find out who it is. So even in our life, in our day-to-day life, there are so many clues like this strewn all over. And spiritual journey is nothing but following these hints which have been dropped. And if we follow these hints, first of all, we'll realize that we're not this body. Secondly, we'll realize that we're not this personality, this mind, this intelligence, this talent. We are something more. We don't know what that is. People say that we are divine. But let's leave that to experience. But at least we are not this body, we are not this. What's the great deal? Alright, I'm not this body, what's the great deal? As somebody says, even in a dream, you hammer with a dream hammer, it pains, right? Pain is real. You can tell me that I'm not this body, but pain hurts, isn't it? Suffering does pinch somewhere. Then how do you say that this is not real? How do you live with that? That's why I'm saying that all this is our experience in day-to-day life. For instance, I have a mobile phone here. And whoever has a phone like this, a smartphone like this, the first thing which we do after buying a phone is, we buy something called a screen guard and we put it on the screen. You know, we stick a screen guard on this. It's a very, very funny thing which we do. Why do we do that? So that scratches don't come on the screen. Why do we don't want scratches on the screen? Because it kind of hampers the experience of using the screen, right? You have scratches on the screen. But I put a screen guard. I have scratches on the screen guard. I use it with the scratches. I don't mind. But still I put a screen guard. What is the idea behind it? In the back of my mind I know, let as many scratches come on it, the scratches are coming on a temporary surface. It is not coming on the real surface. And that gives me so much peace of mind, doesn't it? Scratches are still there. Accidents are still happening. Scratches are being sustained. But I am not disturbed by it, because I know that the scratches are not coming on the actual surface. So at any time I can peel off the screen guard and put a new one. And how much peace of mind does that give me? If that is the case for a 50,000, 40,000, 30,000 investment that we've made, which is a mobile phone, what about this life? When we go through life, we cannot deny the existence of pain, we cannot deny the sufferings we go through, but this thought that it is coming on a self which is not my real self, it is happening to a personality which is not my real personality, how much peace of mind does it give me? I don't know if any of you have experienced this. Sometimes when you are dreaming, in a dream state, suddenly it occurs. It's after all a dream. You have not woken up from the dream, you are still dreaming, but in the dream it occurs to you, it's after all a dream. Have you experienced the calm which comes on you then, even in the dream state? And that's exactly what Swami says. Life is a dream, realize it. Swami doesn't say life is a dream, wake up from it. He says life is a dream, realize it. Because the moment you realize it's just a dream, you become a witness. You become a person who is sitting and watching the movie. You go through the emotions which the movie portrays, you go through the plot and enjoy the movie, but at no point you're going to be disturbed by the movie. Because you become a witness. And that is what happens when you slowly start living more in that real self which we are. So let's realization come whenever it comes. I don't know when it's going to come. But am I not able to bring the experience and apply it in day-to-day life and lead a good life? After all, that is what we all want, isn't it? Till I am out of this trap, how can I lead this life best? Many times before now I speak, I say this, you know, Sanskrit is a very, very beautiful language, and the way Sanskrit is used by our scriptures with Upanishads is phenomenal. There is always a very, very deep connotation with the words which are picked up. And that is why Adi Shankara says, Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. What is the antonym of Satyam? Asatyam, right? Why didn't he say Brahma Satyam Jagam Asatyam? Why Mithya? Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. Mithya is something which is momentary, something which is ephemeral. So he doesn't say that the world is unreal. The world is a real experience for all of us. We are going through it. But it is not the only reality. It is a speck in the reality. So it is Mithya. It is something which comes and goes. What doesn't go, doesn't come, is Brahman. So Brahma Satyam, the truth is only one, but what you see is Jagan Mithya. It is changing all the time. It is not Asatyam. And that is why when Swami says, you know, one of the most popular philosophies in Advaita, they say the neti neti philosophy, not this, not this, not this. The aspirant who is trying to reach his inner self is say that, no, I am not the body, I am not the mind, I am not the intellect, I am not the chitta, I am not the ahankara, neti, neti, neti. Swami says wrong. That is the wrong approach. Swami says neti means not only this, not only this. So when you say neti, neti, I am not only the body, I am not only the mind, I am not only this experience, I am not only this dream, I am not only this waking state, I am all this. So the reality is something which is all this, but cannot be defined by any one of this. Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. Now when I said that we are strewn with hints, we have to pick up these hints, I feel that is where the approach which Swami takes to explaining some of these things is brilliant. In a discourse I came across, Swami says, all of us have some health problem, we run to the doctor. There is a danger to our life, we try to get some help. Why do we do that? Swami says, because inbuilt, we all have the desire for immortality. We all want to live forever. Somewhere in there, there is that thought. That is why you would have all these scriptures, you have all these mythological stories where these asuras will always come and ask, I want to live forever. And when we studied, when we were kids, we were told that, see, he's a bad man, he wants to live forever. He's a bad man, he wants to remain immortal. But Swami says, no. The fact is, you are immortal, and that is why that desire keeps popping up again and again. Because you don't know that you already are immortal, it becomes a desire. If you realize that you already are immortal, you will not ask for it, right? And Swami says that it is that inbuilt nature which kind of bubbles up as this desire to be immortal. And because we think that we are this body, when this body is facing the danger of perishing, we run for help. Because if we know that we are not the body, we will not try to seek immortality through the body, isn't it? And that is the beauty, because in everyday experience we are going through some of these things which just needs nothing but a tweak in perspective. Once a devotee was in Swami's presence in the interview room, and he asked this question. He said, Swami, you say all this, you're not the body, you're not the thing, you're divine and all that. I really cannot relate to it, Swami. I mean, what is it? This is my real experience. I'm living this experience. You come and tell me that you're divine. I really cannot, can't get the idea of this. And the person says that Swami became restless. Oh God, I have to tell him something. I have to convince him now. What is the best example you give him? And Swami starts looking around the interview room. And Swami said, see, look at that bulb. He looks at it, he says, yes. And the problem with all of us is we've heard so many discourses that the moment Swami points at the bulb, we know what he's hinting at. Bulbs are many, current is one. We've heard it so many times. So Swami says, look at that bulb. And then Swami said, there is the bulb, but the bulb is glowing because of the current. All that I'm telling you is, right now you're thinking you're the bulb, I am just telling you you're the current, that's all. You think you're the bulb, I'm telling you you're the current, that's all, it's finished. That's all is the difference. It is just this change in perspective. Every day we get up in the morning and men shave, we cut our nails, we cut our hair. It is a part of our body which is being cut and thrown, but we don't mind. Why is it that we don't mind? Is it not my body? But let it be a part of my brain which is cut and thrown, we finished. In fact, that is what, neurologists are slowly coming to believe, because earlier they used to find a tumor, operate, remove it. But they don't realize that even very, very small parts of the brain actually have coded in them some very important information. Like, they found this patient who had this problem. Every time his mother would come into his presence, she would get suspicious. Who is this imposter? They found, what is this problem? Whatever cannot be explained through neurology will be explained as psychology. It's a psychological problem. It's a psychopathic problem. But later they realized that there is this one part in the brain which does face recognition. There is a completely different part in the brain which does voice recognition. And during some surgery, this fellow's face recognition part has been removed. So every time his mother comes in front of him, he thinks, hey, she sounds like my mother, but she does not look like my mother. And so he thinks that somebody is pretending to be his mother. So one part of the brain going, it's very, very dangerous. So what do we do now? But why is it that the same body, we have some parts which can be dispensed, but some parts which are so essential? But if we go into the science of them, you take my nail, you go into it, what do you find? You'll find proteins. You go into it, what do you find? You'll find the common organic compounds like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, etc., etc. You take a part of the brain, go into it, what you will find? You will find proteins, you will find amino acids, you will find hormones. Go into it, what you will find? Again the same compounds, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen. So what is the difference? The difference is one thing. Essentially they are same, functionally they are different. Essentially, all organs in our body, in your body, this mic, this table, essentially we all are same, but functionally we all are different. And what does Swami say? Now you are giving all your importance to the functionality, give importance to the essence. If you start believing that you are the essence instead of the function this component is playing, then you are actually living in your true self. But fine, how do we do that now? How do we do this? All this is fine. How do we get there? How do we start living a life where we are living from our true self? I think these are the words of Chanakya, but very, very often used by Swami. There are four ways, four steps, Swami says. Tyaja durjana samsargam, bhaja sadhu samagamam, kuru punya mahoratram, smara nitya anityatam. Tyaja durjana samsargam, run away from bad company, come to it later. Bhaja sadhu samagamam, be in the company of good. Kuru punya mahoratram, day and night indulge in good activities. Smara nitya anityatam. Constantly think about what is real and what is unreal. Constantly think about what is permanent and what is temporary. Bhaja sadhu samagama. What is it? Why is it important? What is that good company and what is that bad company? That company which kind of makes you act every time with the belief that you're the body and you're this personality is the bad company here. No, don't we see that every day hitting our face in day-to-day life? The best example you can come across is what we see in television. They make you believe that if you're fair, you can be confident. They make you believe if you're tall, you can be confident. Isn't it over and over again reiterating to you that you are the body, you're the body, your body is looking good, you're looking good. Your body is fit, you are fit. So there is company of some people, some objects, some situations which will keep reiterating to us that yes, we are the body, we are the mind, we are the body, we are the mind. Can we consciously keep away from that? It's not easy, of course it's not. That's why it said tyaja durjana samsargam. You have to willfully sacrifice it. The word used is tyaja. Sacrifice it willfully. But I think Swami also realizes that it's not easy, it's not very, very simple. For instance, in the earlier days when Swami used to talk to students in the 70s and 80s, Swami would strictly tell them, when you go home for vacation, no watching TV. It was easy because the TV had only 2 or 3 hours of good content. You just have to keep away from TV for 2 or 3 hours. The remaining time it's for the farmers and everybody else. You're not worried about it anyway. But later years, Swami would say, don't go out for a movie. Okay, you can't stop watching TV, but at least can you stop yourself going out and indulging in an activity like that? Reminded of a beautiful incident which one of my seniors were telling. They were going out for vacations and Swami called this boy and said, hey, strictly no watching TV. And this boy said, yes, Swami. He had the confidence that he could pull it through. So he said, yes, Swami, definitely. Goes back home, all through the vacation, does not watch TV. Why? There is no TV at home. It's okay. But last 3-4 days, he goes to his brother's place, where there is a TV, but still he is not watch the TV. So when you follow Swami's command, you know, there's a certain kind of ego which comes. That confidence kind of ripens into ego. I've done it. The last day, he's leaving his brother's house, he's taken his luggage, he's stepping out of the house, and just then somebody switches on the TV. And suddenly the noise, it distracts him, he turns back. Okay, it's the TV. And he turns and he goes off. comes to Parthi. Swami comes to him wagging his finger. Bad boy. He said, no Swami, good boy. I've not watched TV. He said, you watch TV. He said, no Swami, I didn't watch TV. I strictly kept away from this. Swami said, no, you watch TV. And you know, this boy kind of got into a fight. He said, no Swami, how can you do that? That confidence which became ego. Then Swami came close to him and said, you saw for 1 second. Didn't you watch for 1 second? And then Swami said, I'm very happy with you. I just wanted to tell you that I'm always with you. But you know, that was Swami. Swami also was saying that yes, it is difficult. Swami acknowledged that it was difficult. But if you're serious about something, you have to be serious, right? If you're focused about something, you have to be focused. The second thing, of course, is Kuru Punya Mahoratra. Do good. Now, why is it necessary to do good? I feel without our knowledge, without our recognition, we all are constantly doing activities which we are doing from the belief that we are not this body, we are not this, from the belief that we are the real self. How is it? 90% or 95% of whatever we do it so that it will benefit this body or benefit this person whom I call myself. Right? I study something because I'm going to get something out of it. I do my everyday work because I'm going to get a salary which is going to nourish me. But there are some things which I do purely for the joy of it. Purely for the joy of it. Or sometimes even for no joy. It just comes spontaneously. Just imagine you're walking down a lane, looking for somebody's house, you're talking on the mobile phone, you trip over a stone. This is the simplest example. I'm sure there'll be many, many. You can think for yourself some of these activities. You trip over a stone. You're still talking over the phone. Without being conscious of it, you bend down, pick up the stone, throw it in the corner. You're not going to walk down that lane again, let's say. You're not going to trip across the same stone. But you do it without even thinking, because you have the feeling that let not anybody else trip over it. Your body does not gain anything out of it. Your mind does not gain anything out of it, but still you're doing. Isn't it coming purely from that real self that you are? And that is why Swami would often say, do selfless acts. Do actions which are selfless. Do seva. Why? Because it is coming from a very, very pure inner real self of us. Whether we know it or not, whether we know that I am divine or not, it doesn't matter. It is coming from a very, very pure inner core of yourself. Are we doing everything selflessly? No, we are not. Because the direct expression of us believing that we are the body is the sense of doership. We all are doing it with doership. But that's the beauty. Somewhere in that there is a sense of selflessness. Whenever somebody says that, you are divine. In the Bhagavad Gita also it is said that you are beyond the body, you cannot be deluded, Maya cannot touch you. Then why am I deluded? Come on. You are telling me that I am God. God cannot be deluded. But you are telling me that you are deluded. You are under the delusion that you are not the, you are the body. So who is deluded then? If I am beyond delusion, then who is deluded? Who has to go through this process of giving up this delusion? You say it is the ego, but the ego is unreal. The ego is like a water bubble, it's come and go. So who is deluded? I think there's no answer to this, at least I have not come up with an answer to it. But many times when I look at it, I think it's similar to some situation which we find in chemistry. I'm going to very simplify this concept and tell you. Most of organic chemistry is we find a compound, and most of our understanding of that compound is what is the structure of that compound. We fix the structure and we know that, okay, these are the reactions it will undergo. But with time they found that if I find a compound, let's say I have some particular toluene or something like that, some compound, it is found that 99% of that compound is in one particular structure. But that 1% can be in 3 or 4 different structures. So which means this compound actually does not have a fixed nature. And it is not that 900 particles will be like this, one particle will be like this. It's not that way. 99% of the time this benzene spends in this structure, 1% it spends in this structure, or 99% it spends in this structure, 0.5%, 0.4%, 0.3%, 0.2%. So you have different structures. In chemistry we call it canonical forms. So whenever we get a compound, this compound, what is the structure of this compound? Actually speaking, we are supposed to draw all the structures and draw an arrow which is like between all these three. It keeps shifting from this structure to that structure, that structure to this structure, but 99% it spends in one structure. Now when I'm doing the reaction, most often my reaction will depend on one particular structure that benzene takes. So what do? I create a situation, I create an environment, I create a system where this compound spends most of its time in that structure. Sometimes it might just be heating the compound, sometimes it might just be, you know, bringing an acidic solution. So I create a situation where this compound, from being 95% in that structure, goes towards 99.9% in that structure. Very similarly, in the experience we all are going through, 99% all that we do is with the belief that I am this body. That is what Swami says is ahamkara. We attach this aham to the akaram, the body. So 99% of what we do is based on I am this body. Maybe 0.8% is on I am this mind, I am this intellect. And maybe 0.2% is coming from the feeling that I am not this body, I am not this mind, I am not this intellect, but I am the source within. So all of spirituality, all that Swami taught us was create a condition where this 99% body consciousness keeps reducing, and this 0.2% of you doing activities which come from that source within keeps increasing. So how do you do that? One obvious way is selfless service. Why? Go and help a person whom you know will never be able to come and help you again. Swami says, do it purely for self-satisfaction. Do it only for the joy which comes from within. Yes, it is selfish. I'm not denying that. Because when you go and help a person, you feel good about it. You are gaining something. Don't tell that you don't get anything out of it. But what you're gaining is not pertaining to the body. It's not pertaining to the mind. It's pertaining to the self. That's why it's called self-satisfaction. And that is why whenever we talk of Swami, I would always tell this even to my colleagues. The word sacrifice, somehow I'm never able to place it next to Swami, because Swami never sacrifices. Swami never did a sacrifice. Because Swami was... what was he there to give up? Everything was he. How can he give up something? If he comes and does something for you, he's doing for himself. How can it be called sacrifice? It is a sacrifice of this body consciousness. It is a sacrifice that this ahamkaram is doing. So can you do more activities which are purely, which are coming from the self? This is for seva, but everything else, let me say that I am a musician. Most musicians, most of them, they want appreciation for the art. I'm a speaker, I'm speaking here, I want appreciation from you. But how much am I able to exercise this talent without the desire for appreciation from outside? How much can I draw the satisfaction that I get purely only from within? The more I increase that component, I think I'm living more in that real self and little lesser in that superficial self. And slowly, I'm actually pushing myself to live from the real self. So I don't know about the realization part. When will we be realized? When will the liberation come? When will you levitate when you're meditating? I don't know. I think that doesn't matter. That is why all that Swami taught us, whether be it seva, whether be it... Swami said, do it for your own self. That is the beauty of devotion. Why? And then the Bhagavad Gita, after speaking of all the jnana and all that, What does Krishna say? He says, Bhaktya Mam Abhijananti. I can be known through the path of devotion. And Swami quotes this line in Jnana Vahini. After talking about all jnana, Swami comes to the part where he says, the easiest way to reach this is through the path of love, is through the path of devotion. Why is it? Because at some point you will shift from the idea of thinking, because we all, let's be honest, we come to Swami for selfish reasons. I have one life in front of me. I have a bet in front of me. Where am I going to bet it? The world is in front of me. The Lord is in front of me. So I'm looking at the best bet for my life. I'm giving it to Swami. It's smart business. But somewhere in that process, there is a kind of selflessness, where you put back whatever is your desire, whatever is your idea of goodness, whatever is your idea of ambition, and you do what the Master wants. So it is a very easy way to practice this living in the true self. Sometime back, we spoke to one of the old students who tell very beautifully, you know, this is how Swami edges us and pushes us to actually live in that real state. There was this boy who joined in the 11th standard. From the time he joined, Swami showered his love on him. Wherever Swami would see him, Swami would come and talk to him. He was not a bhajan singer, but Swami said, no, you should sing bhajans, you have a good voice. And some people who have a good voice but never get the opportunity, but this boy was so much of grace. Swami said, no, you should sing bhajans, learn to play the harmonium, I will give you chances. Come and speak in front of me. So much of love, showered. Then suddenly one day everything stopped. Complete drought. Swami looks at him, turns and walks away. Even worse, sees him, there's a frown on Swami's face. Comes to the state where his classmates tell him, hey, please don't sit next to me, man. Swami will not take my letter. Swami will not come here. And usually a fall of grace is even worse than just a fall. You know, when you've touched the peak and you fall, it's even worse. So this boy knows that he doesn't know what's going wrong because he's not changed anything in his life. He didn't know why the grace came. He doesn't know why it's being withdrawn. Not 1 week, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, not a couple of months. For 8 to 9 months, Swami does not look at him, does not speak to him. And slowly they say that, don't sing bhajans, because Swami doesn't seem to be coming to the bhajan hall if you're singing. So he loses the opportunity to sing in front of Swami. And one day he's sitting outside, the bhajans have started, he's sitting near where we have these car sheds. He's sitting there. And he breaks down. He says, Swami, what is this? Why are you doing this to me? I've not done anything wrong. Why are you doing this to me? And bhajans are going on, and goes into this process of self-introspection. And then suddenly he says, Swami, do I love you because you came and spoke to me? Do I love you because you gave me this opportunity to offer my talent in front of you? Yes, it looks like I did, because now when you are giving me a different kind of treatment, I'm finding it difficult to love you. So can I take this love beyond Swami's physical reaction? And he said, Swami, what does it matter if you speak to me or you don't speak to me? I love you. What does it matter if I can sing for you or I can't sing for you? I love you. What does it matter whether you smile at me or you frown at me? I love you. And just when this thought came, and it was like a revelation, and came so much of satisfaction. And he looks up, who does he see? Swami walks down and comes. Swami comes there, looks at him and says, come. And this boy goes and breaks down. Swami does not speak anything. Swami does not say that, oh, I didn't speak to you for 9 months, or, you know, what you had was a good thought. Nothing. Swami just pats him on his back and walks away. From the next day, everything is normal. Because devotion is an opportunity for you to love without seeking anything. It is an opportunity for you to say that, I want to live for you. Not for this body, not for this personality, not for the ambitions that this body carries, but I want to live for you. And it is, devotion is like that, in the Matsyavatar you have that small fish which grows and grows and grows, it's like that. Just put it in your heart, it will take its own course. You don't have to do anything. That when it is put, it starts growing. And what is the kind of love? I'm surely going to stop with this. You know, in old Vrindavan, there is this, the old bungalow was there. Swami used to have this flight of steps which Swami used to come down from. And just next to the flight of steps was this window. So that was prime real estate. Because in the mornings when Swami would come for darshan, all these boys would go and, you know, peer through that window. Why? Because that was the closest. The window was here and Swami would come walking down like this. So you could have the closest darshan of Swami. So that small 3 foot by 3 foot window would be filled with faces. 9 or 10 faces. And Swami would come down and Swami would look, sometimes stare into somebody's face or make faces or pretend as though he's going to break the window and catch the nose. Little bit of nice fun time. So that was to be a real prime real estate. One day when Swami was walking down, Swami had a very kind of withdrawn look on his face. And there was this little boy, 11th standard boy. Swami looked at him and Swami started staring into his eyes. So this boy also looked at Swami's eyes. And Swami looked deeply at him and Swami asked, "Boy, do you love me?" He said, "Boy, do you love me?" "Of course, Swami, what a silly question to ask. Of course I love you," he said. "Of course I love you." I mean, any of us would have said that, right? Because this boy, you know, it's quite a strain to stand on that window for 2 hours waiting for Swami. Obviously you do it out of love, don't we? He says, "Of course I love you, Swami." And Swami looks at him and says, "No, no, no." Then Swami goes on to say, "If you really love me, you won't even know that you love me. If you really love me, you won't even know that you love me. Because that is the purification process this love can achieve. Because when will I not know that I love somebody? Either this I should go or that he should go." I started by saying that we always start with arbitrary references like, you know, "I, my father, I. Who are you? My father's son. Who's my father? The son's father." But in this relationship with God, you go through a journey where everything melts into nothingness. You are only left with I and he. So what are we supposed to do? Either fix any one of the references. Either find out who he is or find out who you are. If you go to find out who you are, it's the path of jnana. If you try to find out who he is, it's the path of bhakti. And you cannot do one without doing the other. And this is the beautiful journey that whether you want it, you don't want it, Swami is putting all of us through. Every time he asked us to do bhajans, he was doing that. Every time he asked us to do seva, he was doing that. Every time he said, "Do this for Swami," he was doing that. What else can we do but offer our most loving gratitude at Swami's feet for this? Thank you all for your very patient listening. I offer this humble talk at Swami's lotus feet.